is correct.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Moments of Truth, the show about my favorite moments from my favorite things. I'm Bill Coffin, and today we'll be discussing a modern masterpiece that satirizes both the mundanity and the inanity of white-collar work life, the 1999 comedy Office Space. Office Space got its start as a series of animated shorts by Mike Judge that ran on both Saturday Night Live and MTV's Liquid Television in the early 90s. It featured a whining cubicle dweller named Milton as he mutters about his humiliating and thankless office job. That paved the way for Judge's show Beavis and Butthead, but after that show's conclusion, Judge would come back to Office Space for his first live-action movie. In it, Peter Gibbons, a low-level drone at the faceless corporation Inatech, undergoes a revelation after a hypnosis session goes wrong, and after that, he stops playing by the stupid rules of his workplace any longer. What follows is a pointed takedown of office culture that has remained just as on target now as it was when it came out more than 20 years ago. Upon its debut, Office Space got good reviews, but it was a commercial flop. Quote, "Nobody wants to see your little movie about ordinary people and their boring little lives," said one studio executive to Mike Judge. And yet, the movie persisted thanks to strong DVD rentals and its frequent airings on Comedy Central. Within a year or two of its release, the movie was well on its way to becoming a cult classic, and since then, it has spawned a million memes and is quoted constantly. This is the movie that introduced us to words like ass clown, flare, and TPS report. It forever changed how we look at things like red staplers and office printers. It has been inducted into the Texas Film Hall of Fame and cemented Mike Judge as one of Generation X's best comedic minds. With its bland, gray environments, endlessly bleak litany of workplace microaggressions, and characters who hate their jobs but are still kind of lucky to have them, Office Space is as much a documentary as anything else. That's probably why it has endured so well over the years. In 90 hilarious minutes, it manages to tear down decades of idiotic and dehumanizing business practices, even though the Bobs and the Lumbergs of the worlds always manage to find new ones to replace them with. So let's get into it. With me today is red swingline stapler enthusiast Chris Crenshaw.
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Printer assassin Tom Hespos.
Damn, it's good to be a gangster.
And the guy who has a meeting with the Bobs right after this, Joe Pace.
Hey, Peter, man. Check out Channel 9. Check out this chick, man.
Everyone, welcome. Sorry, this movie just makes me giggle. The guy talking to the wall.
Breast exam.
Breast exam, man.
I just love how
sorry, Peter, man. Is that over there?
Like, we'll get into it, but this movie is a masterclass of setting up jokes and coming back to them again and again and again.
Indeed.
And the way he, like, parachutes in every conversation, you kind of forget he's there. He just, like, walks right through the wall. It's so good. Anyway.
And it turns out he's Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah.
The best button on that thing is when they're talking about their, like, their plot later on, and they're like, "We don't tell anybody," and he's like, "I'm good too, man. Yeah, like, don't worry about him; he's fine."
Yeah, who's that? He's cool. They never come back to it. It's like, it's so good. Anyway, Chris, why don't you start us off with your moment of truth? Walk us through what happens in the movie, and you know why you like it so much.
So yeah, the beginning of this movie is great. It starts off with so many little jokes that will come back later, and one of them is is our protagonist's conviction that I feel like maybe my girlfriend's cheating on me.
Yeah, I get that feeling too, man.
Yeah, I get that feeling too.
And everybody agrees with him. Okay. And so... So she wants him to go to this occupational hypnotherapy session, whatever that is. She thinks it'll help. And his friends are opposed to it, of course. They want to play poker. He goes because he repeatedly describes himself before this as a pussy. And he avoids conflict. He doesn't want to fight with her about not going.
And so he does what he's told.
And he does what he's told. And you know what he's told to do is to go deeper. In this, I got to tell you, I've seen a lot of comedies, and I felt like this hypnotherapy session was setting me up for some sort of weird, like, sex thing with his girlfriend, who was played by, what's her name? Alexandra Wentworth, who's most famous as one of Jerry Seinfeld's girlfriends from Seinfeld.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Like, the therapist is so, like, over into it, and she is so keyed up over it that it gives you this sense that just something weird's about to happen, y'all.
It's like that scene from Scanners, you know?
Yeah, kind of. And it does.
And it does.
the therapist keels over and dies of a coronary event, evidently. And yet his hypnosis seems to have worked. And this gets to, like, what I think is the point of the movie. At this point, Peter's already a zombie, right? He feels like a zombie in his entire life. Like, every day you see me is the worst day of my life. This hypnosis, which is just treating him like a zombie, seems to be what wakes him up. But what it wakes him up to, is it a good thing or not? I can't decide. I want it to be a good thing. Because, you know, I also am an aficionado of Reddit/anti-work. I'm not sure that it is, because, you know, it gets him in trouble, loses his job. Sorry, spoilers. He almost gets his friends in trouble, big trouble. It all works out because of a random crazy guy who is caught up in the madness of bureaucracy. It's the moment of truth for him. It kind of is, you know, where he is making the decision to buy into this, and then he sleeps like a bebe.
yeah.
And when his girlfriend calls him the next day, and she's, you know, shouting at him over how he didn't help when that poor hypnotherapist was dying, he just hangs up because he doesn't want to hear it. This isn't how I want to spend my life.
He hangs up with, like, a smile, and he's, like, so happy to push the hang up button.
He basically, like, he internalizes phone, like, the Marie Kondo, like if it doesn't spark joy, then jettison it from your life. Like, he just stopped Marie Kondo'd his girlfriend.
And look, I feel him so much because, like, one of the best moments in my life, like, that came out of the tragedy of divorce was when my first wife, who was always angry at me, always was yelling at me, and I realized I could just hang up, and I did. And it was just like,
after that, Chris was gutting fish on his work desk and all kinds of things.
The walls of the cubicle came crashing down.
Then I had a meeting with the Bobs.
You know, I think one of the cool things about this hypnotherapy scene is obviously it's a setup for the movie, right? But there are a ton of other alternate realities where in this movie, like, two thirds of it or half of it are just, you know, Peter drudging through his life. And then the hypnotherapy thing is kind of like either happens midway or it's like the climax of the movie and then he gets released. This is like, no, we're going to start with that. Right. And then it's all just like, see where it goes from there. His character development happens like in the first 10 minutes. Right. Like, there's no further character development really, other than him realizing he was a jerk to his girlfriend, like, near the end, and he shouldn't have gotten his friends roped into this criminal enterprise. But it's an interesting storytelling technique, and it kind of gives us license to just, like, just stop asking questions and go along for the ride. Which is kind of funny, because he gets unzombified, yet as a narrative audience, we kind of get a little zombified, because now we're like,
it really is complex, I think, because he comes to the conclusion in the end that you got to work for somebody.
Yeah. Right.
You gotta bring home the bacon and, you know, just make it somebody you don't hate, I guess.
Well, and what's really interesting, if we're cutting to the end here, but where he finds a dignity in the work that he has at the end of the movie with his neighbor.
Yeah. Like, right.
He realizes that this guy is as free as anyone. Because he goes to work during the day, and whatever, it's work, right? But it's exercise, and you're outside getting fresh air, and there's a simplicity to it that I think he felt that in the bureaucratic world, he didn't see any value to what he was doing, and he didn't, perceive any personal dignity in it. And then he gets those things at the end.
And that's not just like hopeless romanticization either. Like that's autobiographical. Like Mike Judge, when he was first starting out, apparently he had this like really awful office job, I think somewhere in Silicon Valley doing it. A lot of what's in this movie, he pulled from those experiences, but he was just barely making enough to make rent. And he had a neighbor who was like a car mechanic who was basically like, you know, working his own hours, making more money, had a lot more flexibility, was a whole lot happier, you know? And it's like those things are real. Like those are real trade-offs you have to make in life. Yeah. And you have to ask yourself, like, what is it that you really want? And this whole notion of like, you must do this by this age, you must do this by that age, you must do this kind of job by this age. It's like that track is somebody else's dream. That doesn't have to be your dream. You know, it doesn't have to be your reality.
You can see that in the girl's face, you know, his girlfriend's face when he's just like sort of describing what his issue is to the therapist. And she's looking at him the whole time like he's crazy. And he's going, like, couldn't you just zonk me out? Like, can I come home from I was fishing or something like that? And it's hilarious because I identify with that. And his girlfriend's just staring at him like, what planet have you come from?
He wants to be in a permanent fugue state.
Because it's the only way to cope. It's also deadening.
Well, just occurred to me, you know, this movie came out the same year as The Matrix, right?
Right.
Two very different movies talking about more or less the same thing, right?
Yes, they are.
We're talking about the glitch. But I find it really interesting that therapy it's almost a stand-in for drugs or a stand-in for like, you know, oh, we're going to take these pills to sort of deaden our experience in the world so it doesn't, you know, suck quite as much. And he essentially like stops the therapy when it releases him, that he stops taking the drug, right? Like he's liberated to engage the world on his own terms.
So and of course the irony of it, and this is going to bring us into Tom's points, I don't want to take too much from it, but it gets into all this behavior that everybody around him is like, this is going to get you in trouble. And it's like, actually, A, I don't care, and B, no, it's not. And that's where the movie starts getting really, really fantastic. So that brings us into your moment. So talk us through it and what do you like so much about it?
So yeah, you know, I think the sort of the climax of his, you know, I don't give a crap behavior is the meeting with the Bobs, you know, where he just speaks truth and talks about, you know, why he's unmotivated and all that neat stuff. But like immediately following that is 10 seconds of what could have very easily ended up like on the cutting room floor. But that just, I saw this in the theater and it made me laugh out loud. And I was the only one laughing at it. It was like one of those moments where everybody turns like, why is that guy find that so funny?
Yeah, I actually went and saw this at 1 o'clock on a work day.
Well, yeah, that too. But he walks out of the meeting with the Bobs and he's just leaving. Like, his boss Lumberg like sees him leaving as he's walking down this hallway and like steps in, you know, to him to like just try and like stop him and be like, okay, you know, like I'm gonna need you to work on Saturday, which he's already done a couple of times in this movie. But instead of like stopping and addressing him, Peter just like walks right around him and just keeps going and like it's silent, just keeps going. And it is so I thought it was so hilarious because it's the exact same move I use like when I'm walking in Manhattan and somebody tries to like hand me a flyer or like a homemade rap CD or something like that. I just go right around and give him a big ignore. That was like the biggest, coolest ignore I think I've ever seen in my life. And it was just so hilarious to me. Like I just cracked up in the movie theater. I was like, what the hell? It's got so many moments like that that I just love, you know, that are just like these little like throwaway moments that like, literally they could have like been, all right, well, we need to cut some time out here, you know, boom, they would have all ended up on that
cut. What time? It's like an 89 minute movie. I mean, like, you needed more of those moments.
I'm just saying, he could have, you know.
That
is such a great moment, Tommy. And what I love particularly about it is when the Bobs get all mad at Lumberg.
When they start looking at his interview, let's talk about him.
They're like all indignant on Peter's behalf.
Exactly. Because why would you hold this high flyer back?
And it's just a, you know, well, it's an indictment of the, you know, corporate attitude that confidence is everything, that, you know, that showing a good face is what leadership is.
Yeah, you know, it's that, and it's also, you know, the when somebody realizes that they no longer have power over you, like all of a sudden you're the big shot. So like,
yeah,
people are just, you know, they gravitate toward that. Like, ah, you know, I really don't give a shit, and you know, here's what's going on, and yeah, I don't do any work, and blah blah blah.
Yeah,
next thing you know, there are management potential all over this one. You know, it's just
top
it's
management so potential. Funny.
And it's so true. My God.
I keep thinking of that scene in Ted when he goes to interview at the grocery store and he like basically like mouths off to the guy. And he's like, no one's ever talked to me like that before. You're hired.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like you said, Tom, it's just a couple seconds where he just sort of, you know, swoops around him. And Lundberg looks so completely defanged. He's like, whoa, like that never happened before. Like, because like he's so he. His whole move is like physical imposition, right? He stands in front of people. He hovers over your desk. He's always looming, right, with that odious cup of coffee of his, right, is standing there.
Yeah.
And what makes that scene so great, I think, is that, I'm going to need you to talk a few more minutes. Earlier in the movie, when Peter susses out the fact that he's going to get called in to work on Saturday, and he undergoes this Mission Impossible sequence where he's just trying to shut his computer down. And by the way, that was like a documentary. Like, computer shutdowns in the 90s took like a day and a half. And it's like all these stupid subroutines keep popping up. It's like, come on. Like, it's the most torturous.
The thing is, he knows they're coming. Like, he does this every day. How is he surprised by these?
Exactly, right?
It doesn't surprise you anyway, Joe.
It still does. But like, he's sitting there
Walk away.
Yeah, like it's like a defusing bomb scenario, right? Like, he's trying, looking up. He finds him. And then finally, you know, he's like, okay, coast is clear. And then boom, he's right there, like the killer in a horror movie. There's Lundberg, like, you know. And so that whole, it's a great scene. It's funny. But then like afterwards, like he comes out of that meeting, like there's Lundberg. There's no, like, it is the antithesis of it. It's like 2 seconds and it's gone. Like, I'm just magnetically polarized. Boop, I'm around you. Goodbye. And then we come back to that again and again, like where Lundberg tries to reinsert himself into Peter's life and it just doesn't happen. Like, it just.
No. I love that scene where he's at the desk and he's like, Lundberg can't see it, but he's playing Tetris.
I'm pretty busy. He's
coming at the computer from behind.
Not him. That he cares.
And he's trying to, like, you know, get him to engage and to, like, oh, we're going to have talk. And blah, blah, blah. He's just like, go away, Lundberg. Like, I'm busy. And he's like,
yeah, I'm going to need you to come back later.
It's so great.
Well, when he's at home and all the messages keep coming on his machine, he's like sleeping. And he's like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I wanted you to know it was a regular start at 9. So, yeah.
It's not a half day on a Saturday.
It's not a half day or anything.
but during that scene when he shoves them off at his desk, he's got like Cheetos everywhere on the desk and there's like a can of soda. And like just moments, I think what's funny is moments ago at the end of that montage, he takes the drill and he just knocks the whole wall of his cubicle down. Uh-huh. And like it's still there. Like it's still on the floor when Lumber shows up. He's like talking over the wreckage.
I'll just get this fixed for you.
Yeah, exactly. We'll take care of all this for you. And by the way, we just need to point out how Lundberg looks like a parody of Gordon Gekko, right? Like he's got the, like he looks like somebody else's idea of what a big shot exec should have looked like 10 years ago. Like he's so hopelessly out of step with the way he ought to look, I guess.
Which is why Peter's so mad at the idea of Joanna sleeping with him.
Yeah, yeah, right.
He's got a Porsche, but it's like an 87 Porsche. And
yeah,
it's,
you know.
It says my like, Porsche on the license plate. It just, uh-huh.
That look he gives it when he parks it at the beginning.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
So good.
Also, this movie has got more weaponized Paisley in it than any other movie I've ever seen. I mean, it's like... it's all over the place. And when we first meet Lundberg, he's got matching Paisley's suspenders and tie, which is so good. It's so good. So
very 1988.
It is.
But I Lundberg also, I think, is the inspiration for the boss in Fight Club, who wants that in cornflower blue.
Yeah, that's right.
Flower blue.
Something I noticed when I watched this movie again today, because I watched it for the first time in a while to prepare. And it was just as funny as it ever was when I've seen it before. But something I noticed for the first time is that, and if you go back to the movie again and watch it, you'll notice this. When the shots when they're approaching the company from the outside, and you see the big, you know, corporate sculpture of the Intertech, you know, logo, it is literally a square peg in a round hole. Like that's the company's that's the company's logo. I saw that and I just had to stop. I'm laughing too hard. Like, that's just so fantastic. It's kind of like how Peter lives at the Morningwood apartments, you know, but this is even better. This is the, you know, it's like Mike Judge is telling you who he is kind of initially, like what you're in for, you know. But there's
that wonderful scene too, as they're walking back from the restaurants to, and they have to go through the drainage ditches, to get to the, and for anyone who has worked in these sort of office park environments, that rings very, very, very true.
Yeah.
And it makes me laugh every time, especially in Texas. It makes me laugh every time I see it when I'm like scrambling through the drainage ditch to get tchotchkes or wherever they were, you know.
Yeah.
Or wherever they were.
When he starts walking around, like the first day he comes in after he blows off the Saturday, right? And like, he's got like just his civvies on, he's got like flip flops on, and people, his one friend, Michael Bolton, is like, people thought you're coming in here to shoot up the office. Like, that's actually a pretty ballsy joke. Cause like in the late 90s, workplace violence was like a topic of, I mean, it's still a thing, but like, it was a topic of national conversation. It was a bad deal, you know? And the fact they're somehow able to joke with it and not completely offend their audience, I think is a deft piece of writing.
They tell you right away in this movie that they're going to touch on some stuff and not care whether it's potentially toxic or radioactive. The opening sequences have Michael Bolton like blasting the rap music in his car, and then like he rolls the window up when he's next to the
and locks the door and turns it down, and then he goes right back to it. Yeah, exactly.
They tell you right away that they're you're in for a ride.
Yeah, exactly. So this is going to bring us to our next moment, which is so Peter's been liberated, and he starts doing all this. I mean, he's just living his best life at work, right? And like, you know. Like, the thing is, when he goes fishing and like on the next Saturday instead of working, and like he comes and he actually guts his fish at work, which is like, and he puts the guts like on top of a pile of TPS report cover sheets. Like he's just like living complete open rebellion, right? And it's fantastic.
If you're mad at the secretary for putting fish in the microwave, that's even worse.
Yeah, you know, that was a great comment about just like everybody who's ever worked in an office like this has at one point in time run through that whole complaint of somebody's got stinky food in the office. Like either you did it or you smelled it, or more likely you've seen somebody send like a really passive aggressive or just aggressive email to the whole company. Like, hey, to the person who keeps microwaving their tuna fish or whatever, knock it off. Like it's like those little details that kind of
antisocial.
It's not social, but it also kind of speaks to the notion, like when you all work in an office like this, it's not that dissimilar from prison, right? It's like, everybody goes there for their own reasons, but you're stuck with people that you didn't necessarily choose, right? And in a cubicle farm, you're kind of cohabitating with people you may have zero to do with. It's right. So it's the food.
It's like a pound you in the ass federal prison.
Exactly. You know,
so it's like the tragedy of the commons. You know what I mean? Nobody cleans the microwave. You know what I mean?
That's what when he's like actually gutting a fish and just throws the entrails. I'm like, God, man, that smells so rank. Like you can slap.
It just leaves it.
He just leaves
There's
it.
No it's indication like, that he threw you know it away, you know, disposed of it in the bathroom.
No, it's just there. The fish catcher is there.
Somebody will get it.
Exactly, you know. But like, you know, he's going through, he's living his best life. He talks with the Bobs and they're just like, you know, hyperventilating over him. They just love this guy, you know. And it turns out he's going to get a great big promotion, but they're going to lay off a ton of other people. And this is like at a time when there's a bunch of like kind of arbitrary corporate layoffs kind of hitting the country, even though like when this movie came out, the economy, like numbers wise, was doing great, but companies were just like laying off people left and right for the very reasons that the Bobs are pointing out. It's like, oh yeah, we're just going to, you know, farm this out to some other country and save a couple bucks. And, you know,
Bill Lumberg's stock will go up a quarter of a percent.
Exactly. Right. And so along the way, Peter learns that his friends Samir and Michael Bolton, no relation to the singer, are gonna be laid off, right? And they're both described as some of the best coders for the company, even though that's clearly not the case, as we later learn when their scheme goes awry. Everybody gets laid off people are gonna get laid off. They get laid off on a Friday. And so, you know, they go into work.
We find that lessens the chances of an incident.
The sad thing is that's actually like I've actually heard people tell me that it's like
common sense.
It's like the number one thing to prevent workplace violence after a firing is to do it on Friday so they have the weekend to cool off, you know. It's like but it's just a grim notion, you know. These guys have this plan inspired by Superman 3 to rip off the company, right? And they do this whole you know, this like switch off of discs and all that to do it on their last day. But then, you know, they're going home and it's kind of this quiet after like, well, you know, of course Peter's been promoted, but these other two guys are out of a job and they're like in the car and they're going, well, that was our last day. I guess it's over, you know? And you know, they're like, oh, we should have stolen something. And Peter's like, well, I did take something. And he takes him to this field and he brings out this printer that, you know, Chris, you were talking about how this movie like sets up jokes, you know, well in advance. The entire movie, these guys were fighting with this office printer, right? It's like, you know, it's like PC load letter and like all the other like typical, you know, warning signs that a printer
gives you. We all know this printer.
We all know this printer. Like, I have joked so many times that like somehow we have, you know, we have like gone to the moon and eradicated polio, and yet we cannot get a computer that talks to a printer 100% of the time, right? Like it just that technology eludes us. But this printer is like really a bad printer, and finally he takes, you know, Peter basically boosts the printer and he brings it out to this field, and that's when Ghetto Boys the song Still starts playing. And they all just like start going in slow motion. And it's just this shot from the low angle. Like it's this like mafia execution scene.
It's a gangland killing.
It's a gangland killing. They're just going around and it just starts with Samir doing these high heel kicks on the printer as he's just like crushing with his heel. And then, you know, Peter's in the background, kind of like, you know, as like the manager, like watching him supervising. And then like, you know, when the one guy's done, he hands him a bat and he just goes to town with his bat, you know, and
clearly then, never having swung a baseball bat before in his life.
Yeah. Right. I mean,
they're torturing that printer in ways like, how do you beat the crap out of a printer? You know, like Samir's doing those like axe kicks, like Ryu from freaking Street Fighter. Like, where did that come from?
Exactly.
Like Michael gets the bat and he does like a couple of swings with it, but then he swings it like somebody hitting somebody with a rifle butt. I mean, like, where do you get that from?
Stabbing it.
Exactly. Like
the
like,
best part is when they're done and they go and then he goes back after it again.
Yeah, they
hold him. Yeah, Bolton's going for a second helping.
Totally makes the scene.
Yeah, exactly. This is so fantastic. And then, you know, they go back and they've
got like the guts in his hands.
Yeah, like digital entrails. Exactly. That scene absolutely annihilates me. Like every time I see that, I laugh so hard because it's just such a great piece of satire because it's so well shot and it's so funny looking. But also, I defy anybody who's ever had to work with a printer at work who hasn't wanted to, you know, commit equal levels of homicide against that machine. I mean, and you know, I mean, we don't use printers as much nowadays, but like honestly. Man, office printers are they're just the worst. They really, really, they really, really
are. Hey guys, listen, my manager, I told my manager I had a minor problem with my printer. She's like, oh, we can get you a new one. And just so you know, if you do decide to change jobs, it's yours to keep. So I'm like, well, yeah, by all means, order the printer. And it arrived. So I've got the old one.
Dude.
The old one.
Dude.
It's my property.
Oh.
Yeah, have a bat.
Oh, it's good to be a gangster. Come on, man. You
I
got
have a sporting goods store.
Yes. Chris, you have to do this, please.
You know I do. No, I'll save it for next time we get together.
Oh,
bring
my
it
gosh.
Up this summer and we'll do it in the field next time I play.
That's outstanding. Oh my, yes, that'll be fantastic. Oh, and then we can actually drop it in the lake like a proper gangland killing so nobody ever knows what happened to it.
tie a cinder block to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember, listeners, this will all be on the DVD extras that the compilation.
It'll be in the Twitch chat.
I'd actually read in an interview about this movie that there's some like mafioso guy was like, yeah, no, that printer scene was pretty. Oh, that was pretty on point. Like that felt pretty real. I love that. I love that so much. But
Joe Pesci approved.
Yeah, exactly, right?
It was like at a casino. I mean, yeah.
Pacey Low Letter, you degenerate mother. You know.
We'll get your shine box.
The cool thing about that scene, though, is like this movie landed right like in the beginning of like really early internet culture, right? And so, you know, just the notion of like memes and viral videos is just starting to get going. But one of the early kind of like you know, sets of viral videos you'd see where it's like CCTV footage of people like losing their marbles in an office environment, you know, and a couple like choice videos that, like some guy like working on his computer and like slapping the monitor and then just like hulking out, getting up, taking the keyboard, just beating his computer, like taking the monitor, like hurling it over the cube wall, you know, and just like getting insane about it. And it's like these videos were out there. So when you see this moment, it's kind of like, yeah, no, this too is a documentary. Like that's what's so great movie is that so much of it really is not far off at all, as satirical and as farcical as it is.
How quickly some of these guys go from like 0 to 100 when they get pissed off, you know, like even when they're riding, like everybody's at their wit's end, like riding, you know, they're riding the cars to work in you know, in the opening credits, and they're just losing their minds the entire time. Like the littlest thing happens to cause them to snap. And it's like, you realize you really are just like, you know, a couple of paces from maybe an office workplace violence.
Except for Milton, who takes it for a really long time.
Really long time.
He snaps too. Really does. And then when he snaps hard.
It's like there's a whole like a whole subculture of these videos online of people when they're watching like a sports event or a game and their team loses and they rip the TV off the wall or they punch the TV or all this stuff. And sometimes I watch those just because it's like, wow, man, like that's next level stuff.
Dude, there's a study that shows that in Louisiana, judges would give out harsher sentences on average the day after Louisiana State University lost a football game. They've got the data to prove it. Like LSU loses, judges start putting people in jail for longer periods of time for the same
now
offenses.
Think about the pressure. Now if you're an LSU, you know, if you're a Tiger, there are people counting on you who have court dates the next, you know, on Monday.
Exactly. They're relatively minor offenders who are going to go away to like a federal boundary in the ass penitentiary. if you don't cover that spread, homie, like, what are you going to do? No. So I don't know. So Joe, let's move on to your moment of truth. So walk us through what your moment of truth is and why you like it so much.
Yeah. I mean, what I find interesting is this is a very masculine movie. A lot of testosterone, not all of it operating at a very high level, but there's a lot of testosterone in the movie. The consultants, all the employees, the friends, like the neighbor, like all of these male characters. We do get his girlfriend at the beginning, and who's clearly, a lawful evil presence.
Explicitly emasculating too.
Correct.
You know? Yeah.
The vibe I get from her is Bridget Nielsen from Rocky IV. Like there's that same like Eastern, like Russian, like, you know,
sorry.
Has his balls in a sling, you know, the whole time, keeps him in a box on a bedside table. Jennifer Aniston's character, Joanna, the waitress, is a really fascinating character to me because she also is in this soulless dead end job where she really is just working just to pay the bills and hates her job. Only wants to do the bare minimum to get by because this is not like some, you know, self-defining career, to the point where they're like, oh, you know, you need to wear more flair on you. And this is really what became, you know, talk about the meme culture, like, you know, like I don't like to talk about my flair, right? And all this other stuff. And like the little pins that they wear on their suspenders, you know, like, hey, everything's great, you know, and that the fake cheer you get at these kinds of chain restaurants. And she just is like, she hates it. And then she meets Peter, who basically tells her like, I'm out, I'm not doing that anymore. Like this, I don't like my job, so I'm not gonna go. She's like, oh, you're gonna quit? And he's like, no, I'm just not gonna go. And she's like, well, she thinks he's crazy. She's like, well, what are you gonna do about like bills and money? And he's like, I don't really like bills either. So I don't think I'm gonna pay those anymore. And you know, like he's he basically does this whole routine of, and then she thinks he's nuts until he basically says, why don't you come over and watch Kung Fu, which clearly
I
is like
Kung Fu.
Bong. Like she's like,
she oh, lights I'm in. Up like I'm, a Christmas tree. She's like, ooh, Kung Fu.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. And so what I like about her is that she is another entry into this condemnation of the job culture, right? Where it's just like, it's not her life. You don't have to love it. You just go and you do it because you like to live indoors and you like to eat stuff. And she doesn't need to express her personality through her flair. This is just a 9-to-5. Let me punch my card and then go watch Kung Fu with my boyfriend. It's really interesting to me how average everybody in this movie is. That's why it's, I think, one of the reasons that it's so timeless is that people can easily see themselves in these characters. Nobody's dodging bullets. Nobody's, you know, flying through the sky. This is just us. Yeah. And they're of average intellect, average ambition, average looks, most of them other than Joanna. And you know, it's just, Aniston plays Joanna as a very almost below average person. like she seems relatively incurious. She seems relative, like she even plays her like she's a step behind a lot of the time. Like, and I step behind
a criminal enterprise that frankly does not take super geniuses to pull off.
No, but she also has like probably the most, her moral compass is the most intact out of everybody. I find in it that she basically says, like,
ethical compass anyway.
Ethical. Yeah. That's fair. That's a better word, Chris. Ethical compass. And she stands up for herself, like when Peter crosses the line, like asking, you know, like getting after her about former relationships, she doesn't put up with it. And like I really like her character. I don't think there's enough credit goes to the way that character is written and acted that gives this movie a little more depth than it otherwise would have had.
Yeah. I think the deepest line in the movie, which is, you know, near the end when he's things have kind of fallen apart and he's going to go and give the money back that they stole because he realizes they were way more successful than they meant to be and they're totally going to get caught. So he just basically puts it under the door of Lumberg's office and then, you know, he goes by, the place where she's working and comes up to apologize to her. And he's sort of like explaining, like, I'm just a wreck. I don't know why I can't just be happy. And she has this great line. She goes, Peter, most people don't like their jobs, but you go out there and find something that makes you happy. And it's not like massive wisdom. That's just like simple everyday, like,
it's also not what she's done.
It's also not what she's done. No, but there's a truth to it. It's kind of like, it's like Dennis Leary had this great comedy album. I was talking about how, you know, he's like, people want him not happy. He's like, well, yeah, cause nobody walks around happy. He's like happy comes in small doses. Like, you sit down, you eat the cookie, you're happy, then you move on, you know? And the work is not going to make you happy. The work is never going to make you happy. Happy, not capital H happy. You got to find the other things around it, you know, or derive something from it that's going to get you there. And usually it's not going to come from any one thing. It's going to come from a multiplicity of things to get you there, you know?
In his case, though, it's evidently a super hot girlfriend.
Well, yeah, it certainly doesn't hurt, but like, but she's the only character who's got the perspective and the moral authority to actually make that kind of comment and have any kind of sticking power. Right, Joe? I mean,
well, that's kind of my point too, is that where all of these guys keep like staying in harness
they're working at Initrade, but which I thought was Initrode initially, but it's Initrode.
It's like Stark Industries, Stark Enterprises, you know.
Yeah, like it's like, whatever.
Any one of these nameless, you know, freaking tech companies.
Exactly.
Well, right. Yeah, I think that's the point of the name.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely, it is.
I.
Yeah.
So. But all of these guys, they stay in these dead end jobs. Peter stayed in this dead end relationship with a woman who didn't make him happy, and he's in a job that doesn't make him happy. And what he does at the end is he just kind of, he's a passenger in his own life, right? I mean, it's only by a freak accident that he gets any agency at all. Whereas Joanna's character, like, what does she do when she's had enough of her job? She does it the way you're supposed to. She flips off her boss and tells him to go F himself, and she's out the door. Yeah, that's the way you leave it. You know what I mean? And then when Peter pisses her off, she does the same thing. Stop, let me out. I'm done with, like, when things stop making her happy, she's like, that's it. I'm done. I'm going to go find something else.
Yeah.
You know, Joe, I was objecting to her character partly because, like, Peter does not deserve to get her back. Right. No. He doesn't.
No, no. He crossed a line.
But the way you put it there actually maybe makes it okay, because hearing that from him makes her happy. And so she can embrace it. That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's also, I mean, I go back to it that these are very normal people. And it's not a great morality play. Everybody screws up. Everybody's imperfect. And then, you know, the fact that they're going to go watch, you know, sometimes it's just about someone who'll watch Kung Fu with you. And maybe that's all we're all really looking for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if they look like Jennifer Aniston in 1999, then so much the better.
So much the better. Or 2023. She's aging rather gracefully, I have to say. So
I love that Flair thing. It is just so hysterical.
The Flair thing is fantastic.
It's my favorite joke.
Wondering, like, what does this guy want? Like, does he want more pieces of Flair? Like, that is,
I want you to express yourself.
More complex than anybody gives a credit for. Right. Like this, you know, like, you're like, all right, well, you know, if you want me to do something, give me the thing to do. Quit beating around the bush. Yeah. That is a corporate conversation that happens every goddamn
man, day. And at so many different levels too. you know, he's like, you want somebody who just does the bare minimum, and what they're really asking is, We want you to give more investment of yourself than we are willing to compensate you for in any meaningful way. So we want you to volunteer that which we're not willing to pay for, right? And that's the real measure of your work here. And like, it's funny when you're seeing, you know, this complete knucklehead across the way wearing like military levels of flair on the suspenders, right? And he's just like super cool, hey, how you doing? You know, and he's this
somebody's complete, having like, a case of the Mondays.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like that guy's both Beavis and Butthead. Like, he's just the worst, right?
Yeah. He is.
You know,
he's like even worse than Drew.
He really kind of is, because Drew is just like you know, like Drew is as he's he's as unhappy in his work as anybody else, but he's got these like base crocodilian instincts to kind of keep him going. That's the thing that makes him happy, right?
Everybody knows that guy though, like,
yeah, yes,
that's that guy at work who's just there to get paid, and like,
yeah, he's just like, exactly,
how are you still here? Like, I know so many guys like
that. That's right, exactly. Like, it's just like, I'm just here, you know, to propagate, I mean, my genetic information, that is all, man. Everything else is a detail. But the guy in Tchotchkes, though, like, we want you to play this mental game. And that's part of the tethering to the work, right? It's the, even if they said, we want you to wear 37, the point is, who's going to be the one who then wears 50 because they just want to wear 50 because they want to impress, or they want to live up to some standard that is not defined. And therefore, there's no obligation to actually acknowledge once you do it. And that there's, like, it's funny, but a lot of workplaces do that at all kinds of levels and all kinds of industries. And it's a really insidious thing that workplaces do
in all kinds of ways. Yeah.
In all kinds of ways. And that's when we talk about like workplace culture and that sort of thing, you know, bad companies do this all the time.
Yeah. I was in a relationship once where she wanted us to go skiing all the time. And I was like, it's fine. I'll go. She's like, no, I want you to want to go. It's like, well, and that's kind of what I think. Yeah. It's like, we don't want you to just come and be at work. We want you to want to be here. Yeah. It's like, I don't care.
Yeah, that's the emotional investment.
Yeah. Where's
that Bush Gordon smile?
I want you to want to be happy to sling, you know, jalapeno poppers and extreme fajitas. Like, when, you know.
Antidote for that is just exactly what she did, which is just give him the finger in front of everybody and tell him what he can do with his flair.
I'm expressing myself. Which is, you want me to express myself?
I love that, like, you know, that recognition that, like, I'm taking this from somebody who's like a manager, a low-level manager at a chain restaurant, of which there are like seven around here. It reminds me of my daughter's dance coach. Like, you know, they get into it like, you know, 14-year-old girls do. And, you know, like, and sometimes the instructor gets into it too and gets sucked into the drama. And I'm like, all right, we can't take this from you because you're a dance instructor in a dance studio in a strip mall. Like, you need to be brought back to that like world of reality. Like, no, we don't have to take this because you're low level nonsense. Yeah. And would people take that crap every day?
Not the Bolshoi.
You know, the other thing I liked about the whole Tchotchke kind of B story is that, you know, Mike Judge was saying how, like, when you wrote the story, you know, in the 90s in particular, you saw all these corporate campuses kind of pop up everywhere. So like, the story takes place and was shot in Texas, but it doesn't matter because it could be anywhere. Like, it looks like it's in like the American version of Flatland. It's somewhere on a geometric plane, somewhere in time and space, and it could be.
But I'll bet it's Houston.
Right. But it feels like it could be anywhere. But he was talking about how, like, right around the time we started seeing a lot of these corporate campuses kind of pop up, you saw all these other big chain restaurants pop up right next to them. It's, you know, the Tchotchke thing is funny because it so clearly is firing a shot across the bow of a particular, you know, set of brands, whereas I&I, whereas like, you know, Tech kind of doesn't, just a kind of company, but the food is against, you know, brands like, you know, the TGI Fridays, the, you know, the Bennigan's, you know, all that sort of stuff, right? He's railing against that just as hard because they're doing to food what Inditex is doing to work, you know, and it's like you don't necessarily have to enjoy what you have to do to survive, but you should be able to at least not hate it the entire time. Food, you should enjoy, right? You shouldn't. Food is good. You should enjoy food. Food shouldn't be turned into this soulless kind of drudgery thing, like, you know, with like the custom songs they sing and the stupid outfits they wear. Like, don't take the fun out of food. That's like, it's almost a greater, it's almost a greater crime than what they're doing to people over Inatech. You know, it's like, come on, man.
Don't tell anybody at Cold Stone it's your birthday, because yeah, it's just degrading. That's a culture. Yeah, it like the chain restaurant thing. It's exactly right, Bill. It's like they're just pulling all the fun out of it, just like corporate pulls. You know,
happy birthday.
Wait, yeah, the software development could be fun, but it's not.
Yeah. Chris, I just had like a PTSD like flashback to that song, which is the singing and the clapping, like back during the tyranny when people thought "Happy Birthday" actually had copyright around it. It's like, oh no, man. It's just the word. And you know, it's funny if you eat at one of those places, like you can hear the clapping from like across the room, right? Like clap, clap, course, like yeah. Oh shit, man, why a birthday? Like you would actually get angry at other people for having their birthdays at the restaurant. Like, man, yes. Why do you have to get? Why do you have to get in the way of me having my mediocre chicken tenders and fries dinner with your stupid birthday? You could have gone anywhere. Why'd you bring it here?
Suck me out of the vortex.
I just put myself in that worker's shoes who sang that song probably like the fifth time today, doesn't want to do it anymore. And like, that's the extra effort you got to put in, you know, your 31, 37 pieces of flair, or, you know, you're fired.
The most soul-crushing version of that I ever saw was, have you guys ever eaten at a place called Johnny Rockets?
Oh, yeah. I've heard of it. I've never gone there.
So Johnny Rockets is this, like, retro-themed, burger chain.
Faux diner.
It's faux diner, okay? And it's got all different kinds of burgers and fries and you know, shake and that sort of thing. So it's getting that, you know, that Applebee's level historical accuracy of what an old diner would look like, right? Old 50s diner. And of course, they've got the little jukeboxes on your table, and you get to play, you know, music. And it's like mostly like you see them in like malls and that sort of thing. They're not really standalones; they're mostly like in malls. And we were eating at this one, and they had this policy where it's like every half an hour they would just stop. Everybody gets out and does this like line dance, right? And like people are right now in a high turnover food business, and some idiot thought that every half an hour they should stop. Everybody should stop what they're doing. Get out in the custom area and do this little line dance, and then go back to their work. You know,
that's what we need in the mall.
That's what we need in the mall, right? I come to the mall for that level of entertainment. But I remember watching the people doing it, and they were just like, I mean, there were people happier to be in Soviet gulags than there were on this line. It's like going up and down. Like they were just so like they were just blanched of color, and they were just like. They're just so unhappy. And like, I felt so bad for them. I stopped going to the restaurant. Like, I can't be part of this anymore. Like, I can't.
You should hear what they say back in the kitchen.
Yeah. Well, sure, the thing is, it was like an open kitchen. So they stop, then you see them go back and they're going back to their food. And like, they've got orders that are burning now. I guess, you know, it was just such a bad idea. And it was just like this excellent disconnect of like people back at home office. We thought it was a great idea. Never once had to do this themselves, you know.
This will get morale back up.
Well, that's exactly. I think to your point, Bill, is like
continue until morale
improves. Yeah, exactly. The line dancing will continue until morale improves.
I think part of what you're talking about is that when you have a good culture, a workplace culture, and things will spontaneously arise, like, oh, we all get together on Fridays to go to happy hour, whatever it might be, and other. Yeah. Little traditions or little things that happen that make it a little less soul crushing to be at work. It's when they try to when corporate tries to introduce those things and like regularize and mm-hmm. ritualize these things and suck anything that was ever spontaneous and good out of them.
Yeah.
That's I think part of what we're talking about with
yes.
Look, if you can't get it into a three-ring binder, Joe, it's not worthwhile for a corporation.
No, but Joe, to your point, there's a great point in this movie that really undercuts that. And that's when, they're having this meeting and Lumberg goes, oh, by the way, Friday's Hawaiian shirt day, you know, and saying this, like expecting there to be this like VE, like allies in France level of exaltation. Right. And people are just like, so dead inside.
If you want.
But the funny thing is that he does this and there's a blink and you miss a kind of moment, which is, I think it's when Peter has his first meeting with the Bobs, right. And he has his long, you know, talking about, you know, how it all goes and they love him. And he walks out, he's like happy. He walks out and in the background, faintly, you hear the strains of Hawaiian luau music playing, right? so it's like that happiness can be found, right? but it has to be found genuinely. It can't be imposed. It can't be manufactured. It can't be put in a box and force fed to you. And people who do inevitably fail and almost always don't understand why. Like, what else can we do?
It can only be found by telling your boss the truth.
Yeah. The truth. Sometimes the hard truth, the terrible truth. So before we go, a final thought. When Office Space turned 20 years old a few years ago, there were a bunch of articles that called out how it remains one of the best satires of office life. The movie has been credited with a number of things. The movie has been credited with getting TGI Fridays to abandon its idiotic dress code with its striped shirts and its flare-laden suspenders. Truth is, after the movie came out, people would get so knocked on for it, TGI Fridays threw in the towel, like, enough, fine, we get the point, we'll get rid of it. But also, this movie is the reason why Swingline started to officially produce a bright red stapler. They didn't have them at the time. They spray painted the one that Milton had. And so many people asked for it. Like, fine, we'll make a red stapler for you. No problem. And the movie is also the reason why the singer Michael Bolton stopped taking himself so damn seriously. I think we can all be grateful for that. But honestly, my favorite life imitating art moment from this movie comes from a news story that broke just a couple months ago in Seattle, Washington. There's this guy, Arnaldo Valdez Castro, a software engineer for the online retailer Zulily, was charged for theft after he inserted malicious code into Zulily's checkout process that transferred the company's shipping charges to Castro's own account. He then ordered over 1,000 items at almost no cost to himself, like a sofa bed for which he paid just $1. The items were shipped to his house, but the shipping fees went right into his own account. And all told, he stole some $300,000 from his employer this way. Over $250,000 of that was just straight up just cash off of the shipping charges. Now, of course, Castro got caught and was promptly fired. When he turned in his company laptop, he never bothered to delete the document labeled Office Space Project, which detailed his plans for the heist. Castro was later charged for theft, and during the police interview, they learned that indeed he was inspired by Office Space to do this. But they also learned that the money Castro stole had all evaporated into GameStop stock options. It just kills me. And then the stuff he ordered was mostly thrown away. When the police asked Castro why he didn't return the stolen merch to Zulily, Castro simply answered, "Fuck him."
I love it.
Now, I'm not saying Zulily deserved what happened to it or that Castro had a good idea. Breaking the law is breaking the law. But what I will offer is this. If after this incident, Zulily didn't take a close look at how it manages people, then it probably should. Chances are there's at least one manager there who still rocks white collars and cuffs and some team that wears Hawaiian shirts on Fridays. And deep within their ranks is some poor slob in a forgotten cubicle who's going to totally lose it the next time somebody makes him move his desk. This has been Moments of Truth. On behalf of myself, Tom, Chris, and Joe, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Moments of Truth is hosted by Bill Coffin, Chris Crenshaw, Tom Hespos, and Joe Pace. This podcast is edited by Derek Eisenhart. The Moments of Truth theme is a mashup of The Claremont by Flash Fluherty and a little help from a Texas Instruments Speak and Spell. For more Moments of Truth, be sure to subscribe to this show wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or check us out on YouTube or at momentsoftruth.show. And now, a little crass commercialism. Thanks for listening.
3, 2, 1. Dollars.
When Andy Chester loses his young wife Lisa to breast cancer, he finds himself on a grief journey with no certain destination. As he confronts his greatest fears about death, Andy must reckon with the possibility that there may be no life after Lisa. Read After Lisa, the new novel by best-selling author Joe Pace, available now on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
Susie Faulkner has fought against the darkness her whole life. But will her skills be enough against her evil equal? Never Back Down, number 3 in the Faulkner Family Thriller Series by Christopher Swan, available now.
Experience 53 of the greatest weird fiction short stories ever published by Mary Shelley, H.P. Lovecraft, Gray Lespina, Ambrose Bierce, and many more in Tales from the Outer Canon, a new weird fiction anthology edited by Bill Coffin. Get Tales from the Outer Canon today on Amazon or for free on archive.org. The Yellow King.